And again, I thank you all for coming. I welcome you here in the name of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. I'm going to be talking to us this evening about our belief, what we believe, and how we believe. I'm going to be talking about things that happened way back when in the time of Moses and Aaron, the things that they were commanded to do, and I'm going to be talking to us about the things that we've been commanded to do. So, if you will bear with me, like I said, this is going to be a little bit different for me. I've only done this one time before. So, if you will open your books to Exodus, the 19th chapter. This is where we're going to go way back and talk about Moses and Aaron and some of the things that they had done and were commanded to do. So Exodus, the 19th chapter, starting at the 16th verse. And this is where they've made it to the mountain. They've been through the Red Sea. They've made it to the mountain. And God, he wants to talk to the people. It says in the 16th verse, "And it came to pass on the third day in the morning that there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mountain, the voice of the trumpet exceeding loud, so that all the people that was in the camp trembled. And Moses brought forth the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the nether part of the mount. And Mount Sinai was altogether on a smoke, because the Lord descended upon it in fire. And the smoke thereof ascended as the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mount quaked greatly. And when the voice of the trumpet sounded long and waxed louder and louder, Moses spake, and God answered him by a voice. And the Lord came down upon Mount Sinai on the top of the mount, and the Lord called Moses up to the top of the mount, and Moses went up." So here you have all of the people in there, and they've been all commanded to come to the mount. And he's going to talk to them, and they see the cloud, and they see the smoke, and they feel the ground shaking, and it's frightening to them. But they've been commanded to do this. And so God comes down, and he starts to talk to Moses, and the people are still down there around the base, but Moses is up on the mountain. And God's talking to them, and the people are seeing and hearing all this stuff, and they didn't really like it. So go to chapter 20, the 18th verse. "And all the people saw the thunderings and the lightnings and the noise of the trumpet and the smoking and the mountain smoking, and when the people saw it, they removed and stood afar off. And they said unto Moses, Speak thou with us, and we will hear, but let not God speak with us, lest we die. And Moses said unto the people, Fear not, for God has come to prove you, and that his fear may be before your faces, that ye sin not. And the people stood afar off, and Moses drew near unto the thick darkness where God was." So they saw all this stuff, and they heard all these things, and they felt all this stuff. And they did not like it, and they stood afar off. They backed up, and they didn't want to be close to God. To me, that sounds crazy. I mean, I would be right there at the edge of the barrier, right at the foot of the mountain, just looking at all the stuff. At least that's what I think in my mind, because it just sounds amazing and wonderful, and you're so close, you know. You could have a front row seat, but no, instead, we all chicken out and we all back up. I don't know. Probably didn't make it big enough, did I? Okay, this is Exodus, chapter 26. So because they decided they didn't want to be close to God, well, guess what? They weren't going to be close to him anymore. Chapter 26, verse 30. And these are the instructions about the tabernacle, how to make it. And thou shalt rear up the tabernacle according to the fashion thereof which was shown thee in the mount. And thou shalt make a veil of blue and purple and scarlet and fine twine linen of cunning work. With cherubims shall it be made. And thou shalt hang it upon four pillars of shittim wood overlaid with gold. Their hooks shall be of gold upon the four sockets of silver. And thou shalt hang up the veil under the tatches, that thou mayest bring in thither within the veil the ark of the testimony. And the veil shall divide unto you between the holy place and the most holy. And thou shalt put the mercy seat upon the ark of the testimony in the most holy place. And thou shalt set the table without the veil, and the candlestick over against the table on the side of the tabernacle toward the south. And thou shalt put the table on the north side. And so now, instead of being able to see all of the stuff that's going on and everything, well, now there's a veil between us and God and whoever is going to be on the other side of the veil. We've been separated from God by choice. Why did we make that choice? Why did those people make that choice? I've researched the veil and everything, and some people say that the veil was 60 foot tall and 30 foot wide and 4 inches thick. It was this huge, huge thing there in the temple, the actual temple of Solomon. Not the one there in the tent. But in the temple of Solomon, it was just this huge veil, supposedly. And it was woven with linen cords, fine linen cords, and supposedly it was 4 inches thick. Now, some people say that it was 3 feet thick. You know, there's all different types of descriptions and stuff as to what they think and why they think that. But I'm just going to go with this one and say that, okay, it was 30 feet wide by 60 feet tall and 4 inches thick. You aren't going to see through it. And you're not going to see around it. You're not going to be able to see anything. You're cut off from what's going on behind the veil. Now, for the guy that's going to be on the other side of the veil, let's go to chapter 28, start at verse 6. And this is what he has to wear before he goes to the other side of the veil. He has to put these clothes on. And actually, he gets dressed by Moses, and I think I've talked to you before about this. But anyway, it says, "And they shall make the ephod of gold, of blue, and of purple, of scarlet, and fine twine linen with cunning work. It shall have the two shoulder pieces thereof joined at the two edges thereof, and so it shall be joined together. And the curious girdle of the ephod which is upon it shall be of the same according to the work thereof, even of gold, of blue, and purple, and scarlet, and fine twine linen. And thou shalt take two onyx stones, and grave on them the names of the children of Israel." So you've got this robe on, and it's blue, and purple, and scarlet, and it's made different than most normal robes, and it has fine twine linen around the collar area. The opening for the head to go through it's got this thicker kind of like cord border around it, and it's an interesting robe. The coloring and everything on it is pretty cool, and on the bottom of the robe you're also going to have these little golden bells that will be ringing while you're on the other side of the veil, so they know that you're still alive. And on the shoulder, well, on the shoulder, there's going to be two little brooches, is what they're called. They're called, in here it says oches, but it's a brooch. And you're going to set an onyx stone in it. Verse 10 says, "Six of their names on one stone, and the other six names on the rest of the other stone according to their birth. With the work of an engraver in stone, like the engravings of a signet, shalt thou engrave the two stones with the names of the children of Israel. Thou shalt make them to be set in oches of gold," or brooches. "And thou shalt put the two stones upon the shoulders of the ephod for stones of memorial unto the children of Israel. And Aaron shall bear their names before the Lord upon his two shoulders for a memorial." Okay, so Aaron's got the names of all the tribes on his shoulders. Let's go down to verse 15. And thou shalt make the breastplate of judgment with cunning work, after the work of the ephod. Thou shalt make it of gold, of blue, and of purple, and of scarlet, and of fine twined linen shalt thou make it. Foursquare it shall be being doubled. A span shall be the length thereof, and a span shall be the breadth thereof. And thou shalt set in it settings of stones, even four rows of stones. The first row shall be a sardius, a topaz, a carbuncle. This shall be the first row. And the second row shall be an emerald, a sapphire, and a diamond. And the third row, a ligure, an agate, and an amethyst. And the fourth row, a beryl, and an onyx, and a jasper. They shall be set in gold in their enclosings. So you've got this breastplate, and it's a span, you know, so it's pretty good size. I didn't look up the exact measurements of a span, but I'm assuming that it's fairly big. Probably the span of from your thumb to your tip of your little finger as it's spread out. I'm considering that a span. And each stone is going to have a name engraved on it. So you're going to be wearing this robe and an ephod, and there's going to be bells, and you're going to have a stone on each shoulder, and you're going to have stones over your heart, and they're going to have the names of the 12 tribes of Israel written on them. So they're going to be resting on your shoulders, and they're going to be resting over your heart as you go through the veil, and so that you remember what you're doing, that you're going in there for the atonement of the sin of all of those people. It's your entire family. Your entire family that you're going in there for to offer the sacrifice. So, and no one else gets to go with you. No one else gets to see what's going on. No one else gets to have that relationship that you're going to have with God. You're the only one. Why would they choose that? If you will turn to the book of Matthew, turn to the 5th chapter, starting at verse 1. And seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain, and when he was set, his disciples came unto him, and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying. Okay, this is his first recorded sermon that we have. It's the most famous sermon in the world. I mean, almost everybody knows that, you know, how it starts, and they know, you know, it's the Beatitudes and you know, the Blesseds. Okay? And most people can tell you, you know, blessed are, that's how it starts. But look at the first thing that he tells them. Verse 3. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Okay? That's the first thing he said in his sermon. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Okay? I want to be poor in spirit because I want to get the kingdom of heaven because he just said so. Right? How do I get to be poor in spirit? And what is he saying? So I looked it up. I wanted to know, what does he mean, poor in spirit? So I looked up the word poor. In the Greek, in Strong's, it's number 4434, and it means crouched. So if I'm crouched in spirit, I'm going to enter into the kingdom of heaven. Right? Well, yes, that's kind of what he's trying to tell the people. But they understood it differently because they knew the old law and they knew the prophets. And they kind of understood what he was saying because they were there. And they understood the language of the day, and they understood what it meant better than what we do. So that's the first thing he told them. Now, remember the last thing that he did? The last thing that Jesus Christ did as he was there? Just right when he died on the cross? Do you remember what it was? Turn to Matthew, the 27th chapter. I'm going to start at the 45th verse. So that was the first thing he told them. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The last thing that he did, here he is on the cross, verse 45. Now from the sixth hour there was darkness over all the land unto the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. That is to say, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Some of them that stood there, when they heard that, said, This man calleth for Elias. And straightway one of them ran and took a sponge and filled it with vinegar and put it on a reed and gave him to drink. He wasn't being cruel. He was actually giving Jesus Christ some of his own drink. Okay, it was a Roman soldier, and they were given vinegar as a drink by the Roman government. That was a cheap wine. It was a bitter wine. It had soured and turned to vinegar because they had let oxygen into it while it was fermenting. So they gave him some of their own drink because they thought he was thirsty. The rest said, Let be, let us see whether Elias will come to save him. Jesus, when he cried again with a loud voice, yielded up the ghost. And behold, the veil of the temple was rent in twain from the top to the bottom, and the earth did quake and the rocks rent. The last thing he did as he died on the cross was he ripped that veil from the top to the bottom. And the graves were opened, and many bodies of the saints which slept arose and came out of the graves after his resurrection and went into the holy city and appeared unto many. Now, when the centurion and they that were with him watching Jesus saw the earthquake and those things that were done, they feared greatly, saying, Truly, this was the Son of God. Look what he did, even as he died. The ground shook. The rocks were rent. The graves were open. Dead people came out of the graves alive. And the veil of the temple was rent. Rent. I had to look that up to make sure. In the Greek, it's 4977. It means broken or torn. But it was broken. I mean, it's no longer going to work anymore. So, first thing he did in his sermon, the first sermon that we ever have him preaching, he told us that we need to be crouched in spirit in order to enter into the kingdom of heaven. The last thing he did was he tore that veil. He broke it to where it could no longer be there, be used again. So why did those people understand what it was he was telling them? Turn to the Book of Mormon. This is on page 707 in the Book of Mormon. I'm going to read one verse. It's just verse 27. Real short, it says, Search the prophecies of Isaiah. Behold, I cannot write them. What he's telling us is there's a lot of things in Isaiah that are going to give us a clearer and better understanding of who Jesus Christ is and what it is he did and what it is he wants from us if we will read Isaiah and search it and study it. So he tells us, search the prophecies of Isaiah. Behold, I cannot write them. So I'm thinking, okay, well, those people knew Isaiah. Let's search Isaiah. See what Isaiah had to say about all this. Isaiah, the 8th chapter, 13th verse. And Isaiah tells us, "Sanctify the Lord of hosts himself, and let him be your fear, and let him be your dread." Remember the people there at the mountain with Moses? Were they afraid of God, or were they just afraid of dying? It seemed to me like they were just afraid of dying. They wanted God, but they didn't want him too close. So they didn't make him be their fear. They were just afraid of dying. "And he shall be for a sanctuary, but for a stone of stumbling and for a rock of offense to both the houses of Israel, for a gin and for a snare to the inhabitants of Jerusalem. And many among them shall stumble and fall and be broken and be snared and be taken." A lot of us have studied this and have preached this, and a lot of us know what this is talking about. It's talking about Jesus Christ, that stone. And a lot of people at the time of Christ were going to stumble over that stone. Some of them were going to stumble and fall on it. And they would be broken and be snared and be taken. Right there in Isaiah, in 15th verse, chapter 8 of Isaiah, where it says broken, it means to tear or be torn. Doesn't mean to break your bones. It means you're going to be torn. Something in you is going to be ripped. If you fall and stumble on that rock. Go to Psalm 51st, chapter of Psalm. And David got real close this morning. He did read some of what I'm going to read to you tonight. But he didn't get into what I'm talking about tonight. He brought us up to that point, which I thought was really interesting, because his sermon was a lead-in for this. You know, the temptations that we're trying to overcome in our life, the temptation that Eve felt and went ahead and did, the temptations that we all suffer from. Bring us to this. You know, David had this temptation. And he tells us in verse 7, "Purge me with hyssop and I shall be clean. Wash me and I shall be whiter than snow. Make me to hear joy and gladness, that the bones which thou hast broken may rejoice." Okay, so right there, that word broken doesn't mean what it meant in Isaiah. That word means crushed. David basically knew that he was going to be crushed because he deserved to be stoned to death for the sins he had committed. So he knew it was coming. And he was begging for mercy because he knew that he had sinned. And he knew why he had sinned. Same chapter, verse 17, says, "The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart. O God, thou wilt not despise." And he figured it out. He figured out what it was that God wanted. God didn't want him to be stoned to death. God wanted him to repent of his sins and to do something in his soul, in his mind. The word broken in that verse means to tear, just like it did in Isaiah. And contrite means crouched, just like it did in Matthew, Sermon on the Mount, first thing, blessed are the poor in spirit. Means the same thing, okay? What he's telling us is to be humble, crouched, contrite, poor in spirit. To be humble. Humble yourselves before me and do what I've commanded you to do. But you've got to tear something out of you in order to get that. Turn to Isaiah, the 57th chapter. Verse 13, when thou criest, let thy companies deliver thee, but the wind shall carry them all away. Vanity shall take them, but he that putteth his trust in me shall possess the land, and shall inherit my holy mountain, and shall say, cast ye up, prepare the way, take up the stumbling block out of the way of the people. For thus saith the high and lofty one that inhabiteth eternity, whose name is holy, I dwell in the high and holy place, with him also that is of a contrite and humble spirit, and to revive the heart of the contrite ones. He lives in the heart of those who are humble and have torn something out of their heart. And this is what we seem to have a problem with in the world today. They don't want to tear this thing out of their heart. They want to be like Kohar what was his name? Abimai and Dothar. The guys that went up to Moses and Aaron and said, hey, you know better than us. We're Levites. We can do what you're doing. There's no reason why we can't do what you're doing. And we're going to do it. And they convinced 250 of the other Levites to go along with them. And so they had an uprising. And so they were starting to get people to believe them, and they were starting to have their own meeting separate from Moses in their tents. And so God's like, okay, Moses, you go get those guys and you tell them that we're gonna have a showdown right here. Tell them to come out of their tents. Everybody that's in there, tell them to come out, that we're gonna see who I choose. So they came out of their tents. And God told Moses, all right, tell everybody that's with them that believes they can do what I've asked you to do and that you're no different than they are. Tell them to get close together. And everybody that believes you're supposed to be it, tell them to come over here by you. Because we're going to have a choosing. So they did. And God told Moses, all right, let them know that if you're my man, then I'm going to do something that has never been done before in the history of mankind. The ground is going to open up under their feet, and they're going to fall down in the hole with them, their tents, all their stuff, and their families, their wives, kids, their friends that are on their side, and I'm going to close the ground up over the top of them, and they're all going to die, if I choose you. And so they're all standing there going, okay, fine. And the ground opened up and swallowed them and closed over the top of them and killed them all. And then those 250 guys, those 250 Levites that were on their side, God sent fire out from him I'm assuming it came out of the tent and burnt them all. So why did they decide or think that they were just as good as Moses and that they could do what Moses could do even though God hadn't called them? For that matter, why did Eve decide to go ahead and touch the apple? We all know she was tempted. We all know that Satan was telling her how delicious it was and how smart she was going to be. But why did she do it? The same reason everyone else in the world commits sin. And it's right here in the Book of Mormon on page 706. Starting at page 724. Starting at verse 106. For because of my spirit, he shall know that these things are true. For it persuadeth men to do good, and whatsoever thing persuadeth men to do good is of me. For good cometh of none, save it be of me. I am the same that leadeth men to all good. He that will not believe my words will not believe me that I am. And he that will not believe me will not believe the Father which sent me. I should probably make that bigger for you guys. For behold, I am the Father, I am the light and the life and the truth of the world. Come unto me, O ye Gentiles, and I will shew unto you the greater things, the knowledge which is hid up because of unbelief. That's why Eve did what she did. That's why those men withstood Moses and God. And that's why all the rest of us commit sin. Because we do not believe in one way or another that God's going to do what he said he's going to do to the unbelievers. You're not going to die. God said, you will die. He didn't give her a time frame, but he told her she was going to die, and she did. And so are all the rest of us. Okay? When your parents, you know, David was telling us this morning about the cookies and the cake and the rose of cake, you know, and don't want to get in trouble, don't want to get caught. Okay? But you still want the cake and you still want the cookies. Even though you've been told don't, or you're going to die. And in David's case, he could die. Don't, you're going to get punished. You know, I told the kids this morning in Sunday school, I said, you know, your parents tell you your room's a mess. You go clean up your room and there will be no video games until you get your room cleaned. And you're like, okay, fine, I'll go to my room. Because dad or mom doesn't realize that I have a tablet in my room. And while I'm in there, I'm going to close the door and I'm going to play a couple games before I clean up anything. And they'll never know. Right? Till they hear you screaming that you lost the game, or they hear the noise from the game, or they check on you and they see that you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing, and now you're grounded from your friends, from the phone, from your tablet. Okay, you're being punished because you didn't believe. You didn't believe you were going to get caught. You didn't believe that they'd really punish you. You didn't really believe they'd make it stick and take away your phone. They didn't believe they were going to die. And all of us in the world have that same problem. We don't believe enough when we commit sin. So what did Christ tell us to do? He told us to believe. Verse 110, "Come unto me, O ye house of Israel, and it shall be made manifest unto you how great things the Father hath laid up for you from the foundation of the world. And it hath not come unto you because of unbelief." All of these great promises and gifts and miracles and the blessings from God are available to us, the Gentiles, not just to the house of Israel, but to us, the Gentiles, and to the house of Israel, if they will just believe in Jesus Christ. Verse 111, "Behold, when ye shall rend that veil of unbelief which doth cause you to remain in your awful state of wickedness and hardness of heart and blindness of mind, then shall the great and marvelous things which have been hid up from the foundation of the world from you, yea, when ye shall call upon the Father in my name with a broken heart and a contrite spirit, then shall ye know that the Father hath remembered the covenant which he made unto your fathers, O house of Israel. And then shall my revelations, which I have caused to be written by my servant John, be unfolded in the eyes of all the people. Remember, when ye see these things, ye shall know that the time is at hand, that they shall be made manifest in very deed. Therefore, when ye shall receive this record, ye may know that the work of the Father has commenced upon all the face of the land. Therefore, repent, all ye ends of the earth, and come unto me, and believe in my gospel, and be baptized in my name. For he that believeth and is baptized shall be saved, but he that believeth not shall be damned, and signs shall follow them that believe in my name. And blessed is he that is found faithful unto my name at the last day. For he shall be lifted up to dwell in the kingdom prepared for him from the foundation of the world. And behold, it is I that hath spoken it. Amen." We need to tear that veil of unbelief out of our hearts and believe with all our might, mind, and strength in Jesus Christ and take upon us his name, that burden. Put it on our shoulders. Don't put it on the shoulders of Jim Case or Alvin Harris or Darren Kroll or even me. You put it on your shoulders. And you crouch down just a little because you've got that name on your shoulders and it is reminding you constantly, 24/7, of who you are supposed to be and what you have professed to believe in and how you are supposed to act. And start doing it. You know, you can say you believe all you want. If you don't do it, you're lying. Belief is an action word. It's a verb. It's not just a thing. You got to do it to believe. Rend the veil of unbelief out of your heart and believe. Thank you all very much for coming out this evening. I hope and I pray that this will help you help your friends, your family members, your loved ones that are struggling, that they need to understand you need to get that veil of unbelief out of you that is causing you to commit sin. It's the same thing that caused Eve to commit sin and everyone else. Okay? And just believe in the word. And start doing it. If we don't, if they don't, it's not going to be well with them at the last day, and that's a promise. Whether they believe it or not, it's going to happen. So you need to help them to understand that they need to believe. Thank you very much.